So Ecclesiastes 5 and 6 this morning. If you're not there already, please turn there. And I believe Ryan said it was page 555. That sounds about right. Whenever I was preparing this sermon, I thought our renovations would be underway, but they are just about to be underway. The audiovisual stuff was supposed to get started working. Start getting worked on, especially yesterday, but that's not happening yet. But anyway, in the days ahead, things are going to get a little bit messy in here, but it's going to be worth it in the end. One of the things we're particularly committed to is getting a bathroom up here, especially for those who have a hard time getting downstairs. We think that's important, and so we're getting a bathroom up here. You can pray about that. We're having some trouble in the permit process with just where the drain goes and that kind of stuff, and so hopefully we're going to get all that straightened out. But anyway, we would say a bathroom up here is kind of a need. But let me tell you, we don't need a bathroom up here in our building as much as the church I was with 2 weeks ago needs a restroom. What they have cannot properly be referred to as a restroom. It's just a walled-off section, kind of their side yard or backyard. I don't even know what to describe it as. There's not even a hole. It's not an outhouse. It's Dommy's laughing. I don't know if you've seen something like this before, Dommy. Just kind of walled off, and I went back there, and I had to go back in the church building and said, no, really, where's the restroom? And the guy I was with said, no, really, that's it. And, it was interesting. I'm not sharing this with you just to gross you out. It's not my point. But it is, in my mind at least, a good illustration of the relative wealth that we enjoy here in the United States. It's really nice to have plumbed restrooms. Doesn't really seem like a luxury, even. Seems like something that can just be expected. But what is basic here may be a luxury elsewhere. They're trying to raise $1,000 in this church to get a restroom, and that doesn't mean a plumbed restroom. Because we are so wealthy in global and historical terms, and we take what is expected and think that, you know, that is the way it always has been or is everywhere else. And I'm not saying this to make us feel guilty about this. You don't have to feel guilty when you go home and use your plumbed restroom today, or if you go downstairs and use our plumbed restroom. But we do need to be aware of this reality, because pursuing wealth is a dangerous temptation that we especially face as Americans, because there's so much of it around us, so much of it available to us. That's not to say that Ugandans don't face this temptation at all. They're made of the same flesh that we are, and you can see it even in the villages, that people are looking to get to the capital city if they can to be able to earn more money. And you run into a lot of people who want to find some way to get to the United States of America because of the hope of making more money. And so it's not that people in other parts of the world are just absolutely content. But we already, as Americans, regardless of our social status, have far more than what much of the world would just like to have. And yet, there are still lots of things we would like to have, aren't there? Because of our sin and our separation from God, there are many things that we look to satisfy our souls instead of God. And towards the top of this list are wealth and the possessions, opportunities, and security that wealth promises. But God has designed us to be satisfied only in Him. And He has introduced brokenness into this world around us so that it cannot satisfy us whenever we search for fulfillment in something other than God. That's intentional. That's God's mercy, actually, that we would not find satisfaction in something other than Him. And these are truths that Solomon learned both by observing the things around him and by his own experience. And Solomon's incredible wisdom, there's never been a wiser man than he, and his kind of unparalleled riches qualified him to come to reliable conclusions about this issue and to pass them on to those that he was writing to in this book and now to us as God has preserved it for us. In the section of Ecclesiastes we're studying today, Solomon discusses several reasons that pursuing satisfaction in wealth is an empty effort. Here's the first one. So this is number one on your outline. Number one, the poor are commonly mistreated. The poor are commonly mistreated. Look with me at chapter 5, verse 8. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. So one of the problems of wealth is the tendency to neglect the needs of others and to even mistreat them in order to gain wealth. It's been a problem throughout human history because of the greed of the human heart. So, letter A, don't be surprised at injustice for the poor. Don't be surprised that the poor experience injustice. The idea seems to be here in verse 8 that corruption is a common feature of government. And the higher your position of authority, the more your opportunity for getting rich unjustly is there. This has been the case throughout human history. It remains the case today. And this is often done at the expense of the poor, not worrying about the poor and even mistreating them so that I can use my position to gain greater wealth. Officials should be using their authority to care for all of those under them, especially the poor, those who can't as easily care for themselves, but greed and selfishness often win out instead of mercy for the needy and sense of responsibility. So letter B, those with power often use it for themselves. Look with me at verse 9. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. Now, the way that this verse reads in the version I'm reading out of, the English Standard Version, seems to make a different point than the one I'm making here, that those with power often use it for themselves. Does any of you have a note in verse 9 of your copy of the Scriptures? Footnote there. A lot of versions have a footnote there that says, basically, we don't know what this means. This is our best guess. Here in the ESV, the footnote says the meaning of the Hebrew verse is uncertain. There are a couple of ways to translate this, and several other reliable translations handle this text differently than the English Standard Version. For example, the New International Version. Anybody reading out of the New International Version? So I see one, couple of you maybe. It has this: the increase from the land is taken by all, the king himself profits from the fields. The words in Hebrew, depending on which words they're modifying, can be translated this way. And I think this translation reflected in the New International Version is actually makes more sense in this context. This context is discussing the mistreatment of the poor by government officials. And if the way the New International Version is treating it, along with some other translations, is correct, then the idea here in verse 9 is that corruption goes all the way to the top. There are higher officials, even over higher officials, all the way up to the king. And the fields ought to be supporting the poor who work them as a common job in that kind of society. But the government officials and even the king are taking some of the produce for themselves, mistreating the poor to become more wealthy themselves. And even if the English Standard Version translation, and perhaps the translation you have, is a better way of handling the Hebrew here, there's at least an implicit idea that in some nations, at least, there is no king to make sure that the fields are protected. And such protection is needed because of the tendency for others with power to take from the fields for themselves instead of letting the poor gain from their fields what they need. And the corruption in our own state and federal governments may be harder to see. It's not as readily apparent necessarily that higher officials are taking from the needy for their own benefit. In Uganda, the people that you talk to commonly acknowledge that corruption is present in their officials. On our first trip, we were being driven by a driver, and we got pulled over by a police officer. Not really pulled over. The police officers kind of stand there. Did you see this, Rob, in their white suits? And they just point. And so you stop, I guess, or they radio ahead to somebody else to make you stop. And he said that the police will pull you over for no reason at all just to try to get money out of you. And if they're hungry, it's lunchtime or something, they'll pull you over and kind of look over your car and say, are you sure this car is working correctly? And the idea is that you would say, well, here's some money. And then they're like, oh, okay, your car looks good. And then you go on. This is common. Talking with a number of other people in the adoption process who had run into all sorts of snags, and one family in particular who had some people turn against them because they learned that they weren't going to be able to use them to get money from America. And so they began to oppose their adoption. And it was actually a Ugandan pastor who was doing this. And he would go to all these offices where this family needed to go for their adoption process and give money to people in those offices so that they would take their file and just set it aside. And this is just common. Money often gets you what you need in a timely manner, and lack of it can get you really stuck. In other parts of the world, corruption in government is quite obvious. But even here, official positions are often sought for selfish reasons rather than public service, right? Do you agree with that? At least in some cases, people are seeking offices to elevate themselves, to gain greater status and authority and influence and perhaps money, rather than to serve those that are electing them. And decisions, then, are often made by these people to protect those positions rather than to serve those constituents. I'm not breaking down your rosy view of government, am I? I'm not saying this happens all the time, but it does happen at least some of the time, right? Because the natural tendency of our sinful flesh is towards greed, not towards serving others. God has to change our hearts through the gospel so that we would follow Jesus in serving others rather than serving ourselves. And people who can be taken advantage of, like the poor, who have less resources to defend themselves, they often are taken advantage of, even today. But God created us to love others. That's why he created us, not to mistreat them. So this is one of the built-in dangers of pursuing wealth that makes it a frustrating effort. It doesn't end with what we should be living for, loving God and loving others, especially the needy. Pursuing wealth doesn't lead to the purpose for which we were created. It actually leads away from that purpose. And so it becomes vain and worthless and frustrating because we were designed to love others. The poor are going to come back into view at the end of our section, but now the focus zeroes in on the inability to find satisfaction in wealth itself. Notice verse 10 with me. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. So number two, very directly, wealth will not bring satisfaction. The more you get, the more you want. This is a law of the sinful human flesh. It's never satisfied with what it lusts after. This is particularly the case with money. The greedy soul always wants more. And money and the stuff it buys just aren't valuable enough. They're not good enough to fulfill people who are made in the image of God to have a relationship with God. Money's just not good enough to fill in that hole in people's souls that were made to find fulfillment in God. One person that I was reading who was commenting on Ecclesiastes 5 has said it very memorably this way. If anything is worse than the addiction money brings, it's the emptiness it leaves. Man with eternity in his heart, something referenced back in chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes, man with eternity in his heart needs better nourishment than this. People cannot find satisfaction in wealth because we weren't made to find satisfaction in stuff, but in God himself. So pursuing money, which is such a common human effort, is worthless and frustrating in the end. Solomon continues in verse 11. Read it with me. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Wealth doesn't bring satisfaction, first of all, letter A, because there's never enough wealth for the greedy. Not only do the greedy never reach a point of contentment with their wealth, but possessions have a tendency of getting used up. You ever feel like this a few days after going to the grocery store? I went to the grocery store and spent a lot of money to fill up my pantry and my refrigerator, and I go to my pantry and it doesn't look so full anymore. Or when you saved up some money only to face an unexpected bill. Something in your car breaks down, something happens to your house, and this money you'd saved up for vacation or just for, you know, additional savings for future purposes is then gone. This happens commonly. You might as well, this verse is saying, just try to enjoy looking at the full pantry, the nice balance in your bank account for the short while they remain, because they're not going to last. And what further adds to the vanity of searching for satisfaction in wealth is the contentment that the non-wealthy often seem to enjoy. Verse 12, sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. This is a very picturesque illustration. The one who labors with his hands sleeps well because of his physical exhaustion. You know this from personal experience. Sometimes you have a hard day of yard work, or perhaps you do work a job where you're working on your feet and with your hands. And at the end of the day, you're thinking to yourself, I'm going to sleep well tonight because I'm physically exhausted. So whether the laborer is blessed to have a large meal or he falls asleep hungry, he's still going to sleep well because he's physically exhausted. In contrast, the rich haven't tired themselves out physically, so their full bellies keep them up at night. You ever experienced this? I wonder if the rest of the world has as much trouble sleeping as many Americans. Because of our full bellies and our lack of physical exertion. We do recognize the need for exercise, though. Figure that out from science. You need to exercise, even if we're sitting behind a computer desk all day long. But a person commenting on this verse has pointed out the irony of this, too. It says, we offer an unconscious comment on this point by our modern exercise machines and health clubs. I love what he says here. For it is one of our human absurdities to pour out money and effort just to undo the damage of money and ease. Isn't that true? We can't get away from this principle. God has not designed it so that wealth and ease will satisfy us and fulfill us. Not only is there never enough wealth for the greedy to bring real satisfaction, but also, letter B, wealth may bring pain and loss. Verse 13 with me. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt. This word grievous could be translated as sickening. It's a sickening evil I've seen when this person keeps his riches and ends up hurting himself in so doing. Some wealthy people are so miserly that they won't even spend the money they need to spend for legitimate personal needs or the needs of those that depend on them. They end up hurting themselves and trying to save a buck. And then what adds to the silliness of such hoarding is expressed in the next verse, verse 14. And those riches were lost in a bad venture. Money and possessions are never fully secure, especially in the world of business and investment, where riches are often most easily gained. They can also be easily lost. Solomon continues, and he is a father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. This man succeeded in becoming wealthy, even having a son to pass on an inheritance to, but now he's lost all his money. That's a sickening evil. Sometimes great riches just set a person up for great loss and pain. So in the end, this is his condition. Verse 15. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Just the same as a poor man in the end. Everybody goes out of the world just as they came in, naked and possessionless, even if you throw a nice suit on them in their casket. Getting rich can't change this basic fact. But getting rich can lead to a life characterized like this. Verse 17, moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. It's not an uncommon description for a greedy person. Brings up in my mind the image of Ebenezer Scrooge. Obviously, that's an exaggerated example, but the reason a story like A Christmas Carol can be so well received hundreds of years later. Was he back in the early 1800s? Anybody remember? Dickens, late 1800s? 100 years later, 150 years later? Is because something about Ebenezer Scrooge does reflect realities in the human race. Seeking satisfaction in wealth will lead to pain and loss instead of fulfillment. Money and possessions cannot satisfy because, and this is number three, because God is the source of real satisfaction. Verse 18. Behold, I have seen what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and to rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. These comments sound like what we've already seen a few times in Ecclesiastes, enjoying food and drink and labor as gifts from God. It's referenced once back in chapter 2. It's referenced twice in chapter 3. It's going to be referenced again in chapter 8 and chapter 9. All of that to say it's a recurring theme of the book of Ecclesiastes. So it's not as though making money and enjoying the fruit of our work is inherently bad and frustrating and empty and vain. Not if we're enjoying these things in a relationship with God, with a mindset of thankfulness. In fact, God wants to give his children enjoyment from these things. Verse 20, he's seeking to keep them occupied with joy in their hearts by his gifts to them. So letter A, God provides the ability to enjoy wealth as a gift. Wealth and possession should be seen as gifts from God along with the ability to enjoy them. Also, the attitude of contentment expressed here as accepting his lot, accepting his portion, and the enjoyment of even my job, my labor, those are gifts from God as well. And seeing all these things as gifts keeps them in their proper perspective. they are not the things that provide real satisfaction in themselves. The one who gives them is the one who provides real satisfaction. These things, money and what it buys, are not ultimate things to be worshipped and served like gods with all of our effort. Only God is to be worshipped and served with all of our effort. We need to make it our business to seek after Him, to trust Him to provide for us as He knows best for us. And when we have wealth and possessions and a good job and the ability to enjoy all these things with health and those kinds of things that we need, our hearts need to come back to God over and over and over again, thanking Him for these things, enjoying them from Him and with Him and for Him. This is what our meals ought to be. It shouldn't be that we just say a little prayer at the beginning of our meal so that we can go on and enjoy our food without reference to God again. Praying before a meal is a good habit, a good discipline to remind us that these things we're enjoying are gifts from God. But we ought to be remembering that as we're eating and after we're eating too. So we're doing so in a sense as receiving these gifts from God, enjoying them in fellowship with God. He wants us to love Him most of all, to find satisfaction in Him most of all, not in the gifts that draw us back to Him. Whatever it is you're going to do the rest of this Sunday afternoon, whether it's watch the Broncos on DVR or something like that, that's what I'm going to do. Can be a gift from God, or it can become a lowercase g God in itself, depending on our attitude and our thankfulness towards God as we're enjoying that gift or that lowercase g God. God is the one who gives us these things, but He wants us to come ultimately to Him through them. So you've got to be careful about what our hearts do with the gifts He gives. Yes, enjoy them, but enjoy them from Him. Don't enjoy them and forget about Him and turn them into the gods that only He is. Failing to have this kind of attitude towards money and stuff, that they are gifts from God, may well position us to experience what Solomon discusses next. Chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It is a grievous evil. Letter B, God may withhold from the rich the ability to enjoy wealth. They may have all that they could reasonably desire, yet God may not allow them to enjoy what they have. It could be through an early death or just the loss of their possessions to somebody else. Could also be a form of God's judgment in the soul of a rich person in which God will not allow that person to enjoy what he has because he's treating his possessions as a god. Solomon calls this experience a grievous evil because people are thinking that wealth can bring them satisfaction and then in the end they find just emptiness. That's sickening if you're looking for happiness in stuff. And this makes the pursuit of wealth a vain, an empty, a worthless, a pointless pursuit. And Solomon elaborates on this point as he goes forward in verse 3. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and also he has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest, rather than he. These are pretty shocking words. Solomon's saying it would be better to be born dead than to live many years, have many children, amass great wealth, and yet lack the opportunity or ability to enjoy what you have. And then at the end of it all, not to be loved enough by people even to get a proper burial. And so Solomon concludes in verse 6, even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good. Do not all go to the one place? Living 4,000 years but without enjoyment of God's gifts is no better than not even living one day outside of a mother's womb. From an earthbound perspective, the stillborn child and the 4,000-year-old miserable man end up in the same place, the grave. But the 4,000-year-old man will have experienced great frustration on his way to the grave. And the way that Solomon is expressing this indicates how he's viewing a person like the one he's describing here. He's a person with no relationship with God that provides satisfaction in life and hope beyond life. All he sees is the grave into which his body's headed. So since God alone is the source of real satisfaction, pursuing wealth is pointless. Because we should be pursuing God. And these two points lie at the heart of Solomon's discussion in this section. Wealth can't bring satisfaction. God only brings satisfaction. But as he began with a focus on the experience of the poor under the hand of the rich and powerful, he concludes with a contrast between the poor and the rich. Verses 7 through 9 with me. All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. Number 4, it's vain, it's worthless to pursue wealth because the poor may be more satisfied than the rich. Again, the point is made here that riches can never stop the cravings of a fleshly appetite. Letter A, our appetites can never be fully satisfied. Just like literal hunger is only satisfied for a while, so hunger, so hunger for money and what it buys can only be satisfied for a while. So on the one hand, you may have a rich man with so much stuff, yet without real satisfaction of his soul. And on the other hand, you can have a poor man who has very little in the way of possessions, yet is truly content. Happy with what he has that his eyes can see, rather than being focused on all the things that his unsatisfiable, insatiable appetite wants. There's a fable by Aesop, in which he describes a dog with some meat in his mouth, looking in a mirror and snatching at the meat in the mirror and losing the meat in his mouth. Understand the irony of that? Not being content with what we have, but always looking for something more and ending up losing what we have. So it's an old concept, goes back to Solomon, was expressed by Aesop. It's even expressed in our culture in certain pieces of literature and music. Without debating the overall merits of this particular song, if you know what I'm referring to when I quote it. There's a popular song from a few years ago with a rather insightful lyric about this. It says, "It's not having what you want, it's wanting what you've got." Any of you know what song I'm referring to? Don't say it. It's not having what you want. In other words, it's not just getting what I want. Instead, it's being satisfied. It's wanting what I already have. That's a secret to contentment that even the world can recognize. Actually, it's a pretty good expression of contentment. Not wanting something I don't have, but being content with what I do have. It's very similar to the point that's being made in verse 9. Better is the sight of the eyes, what I have, than the wandering of the appetite. So the one who follows his appetites will not find satisfaction. Which means the poor person who is less tempted to follow his appetites because he has less ability to get what his appetites might want may well be more satisfied in life than a rich person who does have the ability to get more of what his appetites want. And another point to observe that's going to be developed more in the next half of Ecclesiastes is that wisdom is worth seeking after, even if in and of itself it's not the ultimate answer. Even wisdom in and of itself is not the ultimate answer for satisfaction in life. This question is just raised here in verse 8 rather than answered. What advantage has the wise man over the fool? Well, we're going to see some of that in the second half of Ecclesiastes. Another way of saying it, what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Is there an advantage to being a poor person who's wise, in other words? There is an advantage to wisdom over folly. And this advantage can even be seen in the life of a poor man who knows how to conduct himself wisely. Which means that you don't have to be rich to be wise. And you don't have to be rich to be truly content. Letter B, wisdom and contentment are available to all. And this is good news. That you don't have to gain a certain amount of money to find wisdom or to find real contentment. It's available to all who will look to God for them. There's no advantage to riches when it comes to wisdom and contentment. It may actually be a disadvantage. So if wisdom and contentment are really more valuable than wealth, which we will see and which we already know that they are, then pursuing wealth is vain. It's worthless, right? See Solomon's logic all coming together here? And Solomon's words here are in complete harmony with the rest of the Bible's teaching on wealth. It will not satisfy our souls. So pursuing it is a waste of life. And pursuing it is dangerous because it's likely to lead to neglect of God and mistreatment of others. We know this, don't we? It's probably not new information for you we've looked at this morning. You do see it in many other places in the scriptures. But we need to be reminded of it because pursuing satisfaction in money and stuff is a temptation we regularly face. And once again, it's not just an American thing, but it is a special temptation because of our relative wealth as Americans. Each group of people, each nation has its particular temptations, and this is one that we face, especially as Americans. Our problem may not be pursuing wealth we don't have. Problem may be spending too much time and focus on finding satisfaction in the stuff we already have. I'm not talking about contentment. I'm talking about looking for contentment in stuff rather than giving our time and attention and focus to God and finding satisfaction, first of all, in Him and fellowship with Him and serving Him. That may be even the greater danger for us who know that greed is bad, but still get sucked up into materialism with the stuff that we already have. We need these words from Solomon to call us back to the reality that we know stuff will not satisfy our souls. And we need God's own direct words. These are God's words through Solomon. He also has some direct words for us to remind us where we do find satisfaction. Speaking through the prophet Isaiah in chapter 55, God says, "Come, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And he who has no money, come, buy, and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy. Listen diligent to me and eat what is good and delight yourselves in rich food. Real satisfaction comes freely from God to those who will turn away from themselves and their pursuits and faith to him. And the Son of God, Jesus himself, speaking directly to a lost soul, a Samaritan woman at Jacob's well, says in John chapter 4 that everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty forever. The water that I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. So where does this satisfaction that God promised through Isaiah come from? It comes in Jesus Christ in a relationship with him only. And Jesus says again, speaking through John in the last book of our Bibles, Revelation, talking to the tepid church of Laodicea. You say, I am rich, I have prospered, I need nothing. Not realizing that you are wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined by fire so that you may be rich, and white garments so that you may clothe yourself and the shame of your nakedness may not be seen, and salve to anoint your eyes so that you may see. Reminding us how careful we need to be not to be led away from Jesus in reliance on ourselves, seeking after riches and security and satisfaction, because they only come from him. We find satisfaction in and from God alone. As Augustine famously wrote in his Confessions, you have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you. We sing a song that refers to that lyric. Our hearts are restless until they find their rest in God who made us for himself. So let's pursue our satisfaction in a relationship with God, not in anything that this broken world promises us. This is a fitting conclusion for the first half of Ecclesiastes. We've seen hints of how we're to live on this fallen earth, but most of what we've seen so far is showing us how not to live. Ecclesiastes 1 through 6 is primarily breaking down the wrong buildings we've constructed trying to find satisfaction in this sin-cursed world. The rest of Ecclesiastes is a bit more constructive, how to find satisfaction in a relationship with God. And this second half begins with verses 10 through 12 of chapter 6. Whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity. And what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? These words acknowledge the finiteness, the limitations of man in contrast to the one stronger than he is, God. It's no use complaining about life with its brokenness because God has caused it to be this way in response to sin so that we won't find satisfaction in the broken world we live in. So is there a way to live then that isn't frustratingly pointless because of the brokenness of this world? And this question is merely raised here. It's going to be answered in the following chapters. So if you want an answer, come back. Study the rest of Ecclesiastes with us. You're going to see the answer in detail as we continue with our study. But for now, we can say again that the essence of the answer is living in a proper relationship with God, fearing God, knowing God. This is true wisdom. So above all else in this life, seek the King and his kingdom. And satisfaction, now and forever, he promises, will be your reward. Let's pray together. Father, we're grateful for these words. They're necessary to protect us against the common temptation we face to seek satisfaction in things other than you, especially in money and what it can buy. Please help us to believe these words, that we can't find satisfaction in those things, that we can and only will find satisfaction in you. Thank you for your offer of yourself to us, for giving us good gifts freely, so that we will love you. Thank you for coming to us through Jesus Christ. And it is our prayer as a church that if anyone with us today or anyone that we will be in contact with the rest of this day or throughout this week is looking for satisfaction in something other than Jesus, a relationship with him, we ask that you would use us, use your word, use the gospel to convince that person or those people of their need to turn away from self and stuff in repentance and put their faith in Jesus and come into a relationship with him and with you through him. Please let our witness be effective as people see the emptiness of this broken world. Help us to point them to the answer, you and your son and the gospel. And then please help us to live it out. Please help us to live it out the rest of this day. Please help us not to go seeking satisfaction in other things besides you. And when we enjoy the good things that you give us, including a meal to come very soon, let us enjoy it as a gift from you and be led to love you more and not to forget you more because we find satisfaction in what you've given. We really need your help in our hearts because there is such a tendency in them to stray. Please keep us tethered to you, anchored to you, looking after you, seeking first your kingdom and the King, Jesus Christ, and the righteousness that comes through him, believing that you will give us what we need. In this moment, our hearts are sensitive to your word, and we know that we will face temptations in the coming minutes, as well as days and weeks, away from what your word has showed us today. So please keep these words on our hearts and transform our hearts to embrace these words and live them out for Christ's sake. We pray these things in his name. Amen.